From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, preaching the gospel in word, deed, and music, we conclude our series on religion and faith. Reverend Johnny Ray Youngblood tells us about breaking away from the church tradition he grew up in and creating a ministry of social activism. Youngblood revived a dying church in one of Brooklyn's poorest and most dangerous neighborhoods and turned it into a pillar of the community. Also today, using the saxophone to praise the Lord, we hear from gospel saxophonist Bernard Johnson. Gospel music lost one of its greatest voices when Marianne Williams died this year. Music critic Milo Miles reviews a new retrospective of her work. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The White House has started searching for a replacement for CIA Director James Woolsey. Woolsey has resigned his position, citing personal reasons, after a difficult 2 years on the job. NPR's Martha Raddatz reports.
Woolsey told President Clinton he would stay on the job until the end of January, but the White House hopes to finish the search for a replacement within the next few weeks. Because the timing of Woolsey's letter of resignation took President Clinton by surprise, however, the White House is just starting the selection process. The name most frequently mentioned is that of John Deutsch, who is now the Deputy Secretary of Defense. The 56-year-old Deutsch has been a highly visible presence at the Pentagon and the White House during some of the administration's most sensitive military operations, such as in Haiti. Taking on the job of CIA director would be even more challenging, given the tumult that has taken place in the last year, including the arrest of the CIA's own Aldrich Ames, now serving a life sentence for selling secrets to the Soviets and the Russians. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
U.S. officials are still poring over an alleged statement by U.S. pilots that's been released by North Korea. It's not clear whether the North means to release pilot Bobby Hall or if it's trying to put more pressure on the United States to publicly apologize. The North Korean news agency says the Hall statement is a confession. Hall says that he was on a reconnaissance mission in the statement when his helicopter deviated from the route and crossed into the North. The Secretary of Health and Human Services is criticizing the Republicans' proposed changes in welfare. Donna Shalala says the suggested plan would destroy families and the lives of children rather than strengthen them.
Do we want an America that takes children away from their mothers just because they happen to be poor? Do we want an America that doesn't attempt to get fathers to live up to their responsibilities as parents and simply rips kids from their homes?
Shalala says the GOP plan wouldn't provide enough money to care for the kids put in orphanages and foster homes. Republican leaders want to discourage teen pregnancy by denying cash welfare and housing benefits to minor women who have children out of wedlock. The man accused of firebombing a New York subway car says he is innocent. Edward Leary's lawyer says his client is willing to take a lie detector test to prove his innocence. Leary spoke with his lawyer before he was operated on last night. He denied that he carried the homemade bomb on the subway. He also denies that he was plotting to extort money from the New York transit system or that he wrote notes about an extortion plot. 48 people were hurt when the firebomb went off inside the car last week. Leary suffered severe burns. On Wall Street, stock prices lost 6 points today to close at 3,833. Advances edged declines by a margin of 11 to 10. This is NPR. The leader of the Separatist Republic of Chechnya reportedly has sent a telegram to Russian Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin offering to begin unconditional negotiations with Moscow. Meanwhile, Russian troops have stepped up their offensive against Chechnya. The BBC's Ben Brown has been visiting areas of the republic and says the Russians have been continuing to hit it hard.
Well, we didn't see any civilian casualties today, although we were only in certain restricted parts of the republic. The bombing still seems to be fairly indiscriminate. But certainly the Chechens are continuing to resist very fiercely. And in Argun, the Russians don't seem to have made any progress. It's still stalemate there. The Chechens are holding the line, holding the town. They're even talking about, perhaps with some bravado, but they're even talking about going on the offensive against the Russians. And they also claimed to us this afternoon that they'd managed to shoot down another Russian helicopter. We couldn't confirm that, but that's what the Chechens told us they'd done.
Ben Brown reporting. Meanwhile, Russia is asking the United Nations for help with tens of thousands of refugees from the Chechnya fighting. A spokeswoman for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees says there are at least 40,000 people who have been displaced by the fighting. Some counts suggest as many as 100,000 Chechens are on the move. Some people have gone to neighboring regions and need food, medicine, and blankets urgently. The refugee agency says it's considering the Russian request. The United Nations says a UN observer has been struck by bullets fired from the Iraqi side of the Iraq-Kuwait border. The observer was on a routine patrol when several shots were fired from the Iraqi side. He was struck in the legs. The UN says his condition is now stable. The UN has been patrolling a stretch of Kuwaiti-Iraqi border since the end of the Gulf War. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross with the final program in our series of interviews from the archives on religion and faith. The church has been central to the development of African-American politics and culture. But when Johnny Ray Youngblood first preached at St. Paul Community Baptist Church in Brooklyn, New York, there were only 84 worshipers. In the past 20 years, he has built up the church, and the church has helped rebuild the community. There are now close to 5,000 people on the church rolls. The church has a school and bookstore, a jobs program, and scholarship fund. In coalition with other East Brooklyn churches, it launched a project that has built over 2,000 affordable homes for low-income families. Reverend Youngblood started preaching when he was 12 at a church in New Orleans where he grew up. I spoke with him in 1993, after the publication of a book about him and his church called Upon This Rock, written by Sam Friedman. I asked Reverend Youngblood to describe the neighborhood his church is located in.
It is a community that at one time was predominantly Jewish and Italian, and some years ago there was a flip, as it is sometimes called, where African Americans and Latinos were allowed to come in because of panic selling and buying. And it is also the result of an overflow from a closer community called Brownsville, where schools were decentralized. And we are said to have the precinct that has the largest murder statistic. We are pretty much so, I think, defunct of city services, not as it once was because of what we're doing with housing and all there now. But it's looked upon as a poor working class community.
I'd like to compare the church that you grew up in to the church that you've created. Let's start with the church that you grew up in. Can you give us a brief description of what that church was like?
The church was extremely small. I was there even a year ago, and it seats less than 100 people. At that time, the pastor was a woman mentioned in the book by the name of Fannie B. Jordan, who was uneducated and who did not have a great love for academic training and was also pretty much so caught up in what is sometimes called folk religion. It was an eclectic group that had some stuff from the Methodists and some from the Roman Catholics and some from the Pentecostals. So it was a gumbo kind of situation where women were the dominant population and the key leaders in that congregation. And the vision over and beyond fundraising and personal piety and morality had no vision at all for social change.
Now, the leader of the New Orleans church that you grew up in, Fannie B. Jordan, who you just referred to, she thought that you were called to preach. How did she let you know that?
By force. I grew up extremely intimidated by this lady. And of course, learning theology through her initially, it was like she and God were on such great speaking terms that whenever she spoke, it was just a divine echo. And the last thing I wanted to do was either live in hell here or go to hell at the end of existence here. So whatever she said was what I did. She, I guess, was the E.F. Hutton of that situation.
Is fear the only thing that kept you in church?
No, I enjoyed the fellowship. I enjoyed doing the music. I enjoyed learning, though that was extremely limited because I was not allowed to ask a lot of questions. And the reason I told the story in the book is because it is not idiosyncratic to my life only, but there are numerous people, both whites and blacks, and probably Latinos even, who kind of grow up in that kind of situation.
What was it like for you to preach in that church? What kinds of sermons would you give?
Oh, I would give the high morality sermons about no drinking and no smoking and no dancing and loving one another. And, of course, I counted on an amen more from Fanny Jordan than anybody to let me know that I was saying the right things.
Do you give those kinds of high morality sermons now?
Terry, you've read the book. I think you know I do not at this point.
And why not?
Well, because the problems are much larger than the individuals. Individuals do have to recognize that we have somehow or another inculcated the problems of the larger society, that the problems in the larger society are the manifestation of problems within ourselves, and we must work on both fronts. We have a phrase in the African-American community of making it live, and that means that we must make whatever we teach from the scriptures to be relevant to our day and time and the problems that are looked upon both by media and by ourselves as an individual ethnic group as the problems. And morality sermons are really what drove a lot of men, including myself, away from the church.
I want to get back to that a little bit later. My guest is Johnny Ray Youngblood, who's the pastor of St. Paul's Baptist Church in the Brownsville section of Brooklyn, New York. And there's a new book called Upon This Rock that's about Reverend Youngblood and his church, and the book was written by Samuel Friedman. Now, you went to divinity school as a young man. Were the teachings about God in the Bible very different from what you were used to?
They were extremely different. Divinity school stripped me of everything that I really had ever learned. Plus, I guess I might say, since this is your line of interest right now, that I was discouraged both by my mother and by Fanny Jordan from going to divinity school. I can remember on one occasion I was sitting in an Old Testament class, and one of the professors was talking about a passage from the second chapter of Genesis, and he started talking about how God went sashaying through the garden in the cool of the evening. Well, I looked for the lightning bolt right then, Terry, to strike and kill the whole class, you know, for him to refer to God as sashaying through the garden. So it tested me. It strengthened me overall, but I was stripped of everything that I arrived at divinity school with. Though I had a college degree, I was still a kindergartner in terms of theological thinking.
What were some of the other serious contradictions between the faith that you had been brought up in and the teachings you were exposed to in divinity school?
Well, some of the contradictions were to look at the Bible as a literary document written, yes, by inspired men, but not necessarily true from cover to cover. I had to deal with the whole aspect of culture that was involved in the writing of the scriptures, which was something, of course, I didn't know about growing up in school. And that has served to strengthen me. I remember particularly studying the book of Amos because it was one that Martin King spoke from. And in speaking, in learning about that, what was told us in seminary was that Amos himself owned the sycamore trees that he also tended. Well, that took something from what I had thought prior to that academic exposure, because I thought Amos was merely a worker there taking care of the trees. And it gave me a whole new perspective on what the gospel is about and to whom the gospel must be preached and what angles that light must shine.
When everything that you knew about your faith was challenged, did religion itself start to seem hopelessly subjective and open to interpretation? Did you temporarily lose your faith?
For a little while, yes. What kept me there was my love for my mother, and what kept me there was my love for my maternal grandfather, who were people committed to the church. And I then made up my mind that I was not going to leave, but that I was going to dig to find and mine the gold that kept them there. And I lost my faith, so to speak, in terms of what I actually believed in. But somehow or another, I hung on to the possibility of prayer being a working spiritual discipline. And what I did was I engaged in a prayer method of my own that was not that reverent, but very direct, carried definite tenets of anger and frustration and challenge to God, and not just that kind of what I call namby-pamby. But it is the loss of faith that now helps me to pastor people who have also lost their faith.
Because you understand it.
Because I understand it.
What were some of the difficulties that you faced the first time that you preached at new congregations?
Well, I felt at points hypocritical, Terry, because I knew that I was involved in a struggle of faith, and I really did not want to perpetuate the shallow, cheap kind of faith that I felt I had grown up under and that I had been taught. So I didn't want to be a perpetuator of that kind of shallow thinking, of that kind of what I call namby-pamby commitment. And I felt hypocritical because I was in a struggle, and I was told by people that we should not struggle with our faith, we should just accept. And then after that, what happened is I began to realize that I did not believe the way people close to me believed. And there was the serious fear of the intellect that had been taught me by Fanny Jordan. So to bring mind to ministry, to bring intellect to emotion, was something that you just didn't do. And I was bringing that by raising questions. I was bringing that by dealing with everyday nitty-gritty, gut-level issues that people wrestled with, not in terms of not going to heaven or not going to hell, but about living in hell in these ghetto communities.
Can you give us an example of the type of thing that you said in one of those early sermons that ended up being very controversial within the church?
Well, a couple of things. One is there's a passage in Romans chapter 8 that is always quoted about, I will let nothing separate me from the love of God. Traditionally, that had been interpreted that my faith is so strong and my commitment is so great that I will not allow anything to get between me and God and stop me from loving God. That's the way it had been interpreted. When I looked at it and really dealt with the passage, I also knew that when I juxtaposed that with some of my experiences with people, that people had left the church because their parents died. They had left the church because they got better jobs. They had left the church because somebody enraged them. They had left the church because they had committed some immoral act, seemingly for which there was no forgiveness. So the passage couldn't mean that if it was good news. And I discovered that what it really meant was that there is nothing that can happen to me or nothing that I can do that will stop God from loving me. Because overall, we had been taught that if we committed immoral acts, unethical acts, or when things happened, we were not to question God. And now we know that God is not going to stop loving us.
We're featuring a 1993 interview with Reverend Johnny Ray Youngblood, pastor of the St. Paul Community Baptist Church in Brooklyn, New York. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Reverend Johnny Ray Youngblood is my guest. Let's get back to 1974, the year you took over St. Paul's. What was the state of the church when you became the pastor?
Well, the congregation had gone through a serious church fight, as it is called. My predecessor had been coerced to leave, and the people there were at odds with each other. And the offering, which is one way to gauge things in terms of financial support, was about $125 on a good Sunday. The average attendance was anywhere from maybe 30 to 60. And the physical structure then, there was one way in and one way out upstairs where you had to, we had to build a little ledge like to dangle coffins off of when we had funerals. And just really, really chaotic. They were on the bottom, I can say that. And of course, what has happened is inevitable because when you recognize you're on the bottom, there is nowhere to go but up.
What role did you want the church to play in the community?
I felt that the church should definitely be, as one of my professors taught me, the critical conscience of culture, and should somehow or another be able to organize leaders with definite skills and abilities, and that these skills and abilities should be used to enhance life in that community and ultimately life in the city and the nation. And when I arrived at St. Paul's, the people with the basic skills to do some of that, a whole young adult population had been lost because of a fight between my predecessor's predecessor and the congregation. And we now have at St. Paul's Community a judge, a family court judge, who is also an usher, who has returned since I've been there. The principal of our elementary school has returned to the church since I've been there. And others are steadily coming back because they now recognize the relevance of our work and our commitment.
One of the things that's been very important to you at St. Paul's is bringing men back into the church because so many of the men in the community had stopped coming. Why has that been such an important part of your mission?
Well, primarily because men have just been absent. African-American males have not been there. And then the brethren who were there were brothers who, in a sense, had kind of done everything they could do, dissipated all of their energies and resources. And as I said in the vernacular, they had kind of drug up the leftovers to God. And I needed robust men who were yet energetic, imaginative, insightful, who wanted to do some very positive things and not be considered an endangered species and then just sit around waiting on death or to be victimized by those who had given up on life. And I was able to find a number of what I really call blessed men. There is a fellow there by the name of Rochester Blanks, who was born out of wedlock. When I met him, he was in his late 40s, and he had a problem with the church and has since given up his job and come to work at St. Paul's Community. His entire family is there now, and he works in the community. He is respected by all of the children who lovingly call him Uncle Rocky. There was a brother by the name of Leroy Howard who used to drop his wife and children off at church and then go down the block and hang out on the parking lot and just drink beer for about 2.5 hours and then go back to pick up his wife. He has since come to work at the church and given up his job. And is respected by people all over, as well as in East Brooklyn churches and throughout the city.
You said that you had fathered somebody before you were married, and that it took you a long time to admit to that publicly.
About 20 years.
Yeah. Do you think a lot of men who were in a similar circumstance, who became fathers out of marriage, felt that they couldn't possibly go back to church because that kind of person, that kind of life would be completely unacceptable?
I have no doubt about that. And again, as I began to set the example, there were men who started a relationship with sons and daughters that they had neglected, and some who even owned up to and shared with their wives that they had other children.
There's probably a lot of teenage girls who become mothers outside of marriage in the church. How do you deal with that?
Well, there is the story in the book. It was the first story, really, that I wept over after Samuel Friedman put the book together, of Natasha Johnson, who is now 15 years of age. She was the first child born during my tenure out of wedlock. And there's a story in the book about how I was approached by the officers about what were we going to do about those girls. There was another friend of hers who was also expecting at the time. So I just decided that I would attempt to reason with them and take my chances. And I said that, number one, they were not pregnant for the church. So what, you know, why would they have to come up and confess before us? And then I became facetious and shared with them, because the actual wording was, what are we going to do about these girls who are around here sticking out pretty badly? And I just resented that kind of language. So I said to them, well, I'll tell you what, let's get us a Bard Parker and we can solve the problem there. Well, they didn't know what a Bard Parker was, and that happens to be the knife that physicians use to perform cesarean sections. And they then understood that I was angry about it. So I said to them that I will visit the parents in the hospital, I will urge them to bring the children to the church to be blessed, and I will do everything possible to help these mothers provide a better life for the children than they had. That was my commitment. And since that time, Natasha, who is mentioned, has attended our elementary school all the way through. She calls herself my daughter and is a very wonderful and promising young lady. And she's an example of what love can do over against judgment.
What are some of the accomplishments and tragedies that you've recently marked at your church?
Well, accomplishments, of course, is the ministry to men and the way we are able, along with the other congregations in East Brooklyn congregations, to negotiate power with people who are public servants and who are in positions to make changes in our communities, in our city, and ultimately in our state and nation. So that's really, really a wonderful kind of achievement. I guess the most tragic thing, and some triumph has come out of that, has been that last year around March, I had to do the funeral at St. Paul's Church of a young 15-year-old by the name of Ian Moore, who was shot to death along with another student at Jefferson High School, a school there in our community. Each day brings both its tragedies and its triumphs, so that's a part of life in the African-American community.
We only have a couple of seconds left for this, but when you're going through a crisis, who do you turn to? Many people in your church turn to you. Where do you go?
Well, I am open about the fact that I engage in psychotherapy. I have a therapist to whom I go, and I have some congregants who are willing to hear what I've got to say.
Reverend Youngblood, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, for your interest.
Reverend Johnny Ray Youngblood is pastor of St. Paul Community Baptist Church in Brooklyn, New York. He's the subject of the book Upon This Rock, written by Sam Friedman. It was first published in 1993, the year our interview was recorded. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On the second part of our show, we'll hear from gospel saxophonist Vernard Johnson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Some God-fearing people think of the saxophone as an instrument for playing the devil's music. But Bernard Johnson uses his saxophone to praise the Lord. Coming up, we hear from gospel saxophonist Bernard Johnson. The great gospel singer Marianne Williams died earlier this year. A new CD collects recordings that span her career. Milo Miles has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Chechen leader Jokhar Dudayev has reportedly said he's willing to hold unconditional peace talks with the Russian government. The BBC's Diana Goodman has more from Moscow.
On the face of it, the Chechen leader appears to have called for peace talks to be held without preconditions. He's said to have sent telegrams to the Kremlin and to the Russian prime minister saying the Chechens are ready for talks at any level. But even if Moscow was interested in pursuing the idea, and there's no sign of that so far, there would be several stumbling blocks to overcome. The Russians have always insisted the Chechens would have to lay down their weapons before any talks could begin. If Mr. Dudayev was to agree to that now, it would be tantamount to surrendering to the Russians. Also, in the past, the Chechens have repeatedly said that their independence is not negotiable. It's unlikely that Moscow would agree to talks with no room to maneuver on that issue. When President Yeltsin rejected the last offer of talks from the Chechens 11 days ago, his spokesman said there would be no answers to any more telegrams sent from Grozny.
Diana Goodman reporting. The Clinton administration is criticizing proposed Republican welfare plans. The Department of Health and Human Services says the GOP plan would deny aid to 5 million children now on the rolls. The agency also says Republicans wouldn't provide nearly enough money to care for the children in orphanages and foster homes. Health Secretary Donna Shalala says the plan is a cruel hoax that hurts kids as well as state taxpayers and private charities. Republican leaders want to discourage teen pregnancy by denying cash welfare and housing benefits to unmarried teenage girls who have babies. The government's chief economic forecasting gauge was higher in November. The index of leading economic indicators rose last month by 0.3%. The Commerce Department says the increase was due mainly to higher orders to factories and an increase in backlog orders. Economist Jim Bills believes the current situation means the Fed will act again soon on interest rates.
The Federal Reserve has been raising interest rates for about 11 months now. This suggests that further increases are likely to be in the pipeline, and we expect the Federal Reserve to adjust interest rates, short-term interest rates, that is, upward probably by the end of January.
President Clinton says there is no question that he'll run for re-election in 1996. The president says he's not bothered that he might face a challenge for the Democratic nomination. He says he doesn't see a reason why he would later change his mind. Mr. Clinton says although he intends to seek re-election, he doesn't dwell on that fact. His goal is to try to help Americans. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down almost 3 points at 3,836. This is NPR. Tourists and National Park Service guides have been barred from visiting the house where Martin Luther King Jr. was born. King's family has banished the Park Service in an escalating dispute over control of the slain civil rights leader's legacy. The dispute centers on the Park Service's plan to build a nearly $12 million visitor center on federal land across the street from the King Center in time for the 1996 Olympics. The King family wants to build an interactive museum at the same site. The Bangladeshi prime minister says she will step down before the next general election. She had been under mounting pressure from the country's opposition, which accuses the government of widespread corruption. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
Prime Minister Khaleda Zia said she'll be willing to resign 1 month before the next general elections, which are due to be held in 1996. The announcement is clearly meant to appease Bangladesh's opposition, which has been waging a 10-month campaign to force Prime Minister Zia to resign and appoint a caretaker government. Yesterday, the entire opposition resigned en masse from parliament. Today, they called a general strike, which shut down much of the country. The strike ended without incident, but opposition leaders warned of harsher action if new elections weren't held as soon as possible. This is Eric Weiner in New Delhi.
President Clinton has awarded $300 million in grants to projects that assist homeless people. The grants will finance projects ranging from efforts to reach homeless people on the street to building permanent homes. Mr. Clinton says it's imperative Americans not turn their backs on the homeless. A new study suggests there's a more effective way to quit smoking. A researcher at Duke University says a combination of a nicotine patch and a drug used to treat high blood pressure could help smokers who want to quit. The researcher says the new approach could have a large impact on smoking cessation. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A squealing saxophone is a sound usually associated with rhythm and blues, jazz, and rock and roll. But when Vernard Johnson plays the saxophone, he plays gospel music. And although he plays in churches, not clubs, he plays with raucous abandon. Johnson started playing the alto as a teenager in spite of his terrible asthma. He played jazz and rhythm and blues until he was saved at the age of 17. He says when he started playing for the Lord, his asthma was healed. In the mid-60s, Johnson performed at Southern tent revivals. Now he's a star of the gospel circuit and has performed in churches around the world. He's recorded many gospel albums. His one recording for a secular label was released in 1991 as part of the Elektra Nonesuch American Explorer series, celebrating the varied roots of American music. The album is called I'm Alive. I spoke with Johnson shortly after the album was released. Let's start with Lord Help Me to Hold Out from his album I'm Alive.
Announcers all around America thought I was a joke. They thought this is just, it couldn't be a real gospel saxophone when I first started, you know. And they said, this is just something that fly-by-night novelty. It will never take off. And so they wouldn't play me at first.
What about churches? Would churches want you to play saxophone?
Many churches didn't want to have me. And they didn't want to take the risk of saying that they had a quote, a devil's instrument in the church, you know, saxophone.
So what makes saxophone such a profane instrument? Is it because it's of its association with rhythm and blues and jazz?
I don't think so. It's really not a profane instrument.
I meant that in quotation marks.
Yeah, I understand. It's a wonderful instrument. But because it has been used so thoroughly in the clubs and to play rock and jazz, you know, So I think that's the reason why they said, well, it shouldn't be in the church because it's used in the clubs all the time and people dance to it and everything else. So when I started playing gospel saxophone in the church, they had to get used to it. I mean, you know, they had to see that it could be used for the glory of God.
When you started playing gospel saxophone, did you work then with choirs? Because now you can listen to you and say, well, I know that's gospel music because there's a gospel choir. So, you know, even though you're right, not used to a saxophone, you can tell it's gospel music. But if you took away the choir, it would be less, more ambiguous. So were you playing with a choir at first?
You know, not much. I had a few background singers kind of to interpret what I was trying to say on sax. But then there were just certain songs that I would play solo, but they would be familiar tunes. Like I'd play a song called Never Grow Old. I'd play Precious Lord, Take My Hand. You know, Precious Lord, Take My Hand. You know, and then I'd Amazing Grace. You know, Amazing Grace and a few others. But everybody knew the tunes. So when I'd start playing those songs, they say, ah, oh yes, I know that song. That's gospel. But then I have the ability, and I think, thanks to God, I have the ability to compose. And when I do my original material, I always include voices so they can interpret what I'm saying, because it has a little beat with it sometimes, most of the time, you know. I'm alive. I'm alive. You know, and you got to have singers behind you saying it, because if the horn goes... You know, people will understand what you're trying to say on your horn. They say, oh, that's not gospel. But as soon as you put the group, I'm alive. I'm alive. You know, so you put the group with them and they say, hey, that's gospel. So you got to keep some singers to interpret what you're saying.
How do you think your sound changed when you were saved?
It became more mellow, very rich tone, more just a tremendous depth to my music. You know, the sound, you might say, like it was kind of yearning, whining, like from the heart, you know.
Well, there's this cry in your
like
sound.
Like a cry. That's it right there. Like a cry in my sound, like I'm begging, you know. You know, if I'm playing Amazing Grace, it's, if I'm getting that part, I once, oh, I once was lost, you know. But oh, but now, you know, it's begging. Ooh, now I'm found. Yeah, you know, from my heart. Was blind, but now, oh, I, it just pleads, you know. My horn sounds, it pleads like I'm singing, you know. And that's from, I'm singing from my heart, and I'm just, I'm about to get happy on your radio show. I know you don't want me to do that, but I feel good. Excuse me here. Yeah.
Let's hear something from the new record. The record's called I'm Alive. Featuring a 1991 interview with gospel saxophonist Vernard Johnson. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Gospel saxophonist Vernard Johnson is my guest. Religion in America is really still pretty segregated. But you've played in black churches and mm-hmm. in white churches.
Right.
You've even played on TV in what is basically a very white ministry
uh-huh.
type
right.
of programs. What's enabled you to go back and forth like that?
You know, I've wondered about that myself. I was born in Kansas City, and, you know, I was raised in the black church. I have a black background and black religion, black church, you might say. And, in fact, I went to school at Sumner High School. I didn't even go to school with any whites at all or browns until I reached college,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I went to all-black grade school, all-black junior high and high school. When I got to college, you know, we had all these things we were wondering about because I lived in a black community. I had been black all my life. Amen. Black baby, black boy, black man. I didn't know anything about anybody else but black folks. So I got to college. But to answer your question, I went to Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary when I finished my bachelor's degree. After college, I went to seminary, and that gave me, you might say, a more broader background with the Southern Baptists. Then the National Baptists wrapped their arms around me. The Methodists wrapped their arms around me. And it's something about when you get the learning as well as the burning, that people learn to accept what you have to say, and that they'll receive your music even more. I don't know, it's something about Americans and even people overseas, that when you have prepared yourself, they seem to say, aha, you know, I want to hear what he has to say, and they'll accept you more. I don't know why.
What are some of the things that really surprised you when you first started playing in white churches?
Well, you know, I was used to folks shouting, you know. When I get the blowing, you know, folks say, yes, sir, oh, glory, you know, all that. And get up and do the holy dance. You know, I was used to people doing that. Well, you get to playing in white churches. They don't shout no more, but, you know, all they do is just cry a little bit. And you don't know if you really get nowhere until you get through it. They give you a standing ovation. If they really love your music, they give you a standing ovation if you move them or if God moved them through you. But while you're in the midst of it, I mean, you don't know where you are. You got to trust God that you're doing all right. But when you play for black folks, and I hope nobody's offended, I just really have a lot of fun with you. But when you play for black folks, this is true, though. When you play for black folks, they let you know where you are. They talk back to you. You can say, the Lord is good. They say, yes, sir. I mean, you know, and I woke up this morning and I found out the Lord it wasn't an alarm clock who woke me up. They said, no. It was the Lord who woke me up. They say, yes, sir. And whatever you say, they're going to talk back to you. But the other situations, I mean, you know, my God, you know, it's just like real quiet. You know, like you're playing for a Methodist church, white Methodist, real quiet. You play for a white Baptist, real quiet. And then at the end, I mean, you might see them, you know, wipe a tear. And I'm not making fun. I'm just telling you what happens, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Then they'll give you a standing ovation. But that's good, though. I enjoy that. But give me my black folks to talk back to me any day. I want some talking back.
Now, you've played on programs like the 700 Club
yes,
and the PTL Club.
Right.
And no offense to anyone here, but with the exception of Jimmy Swaggart,
mm-hmm.
the music is just like the squarest music on the show. And you are so really out of context.
Yeah,
because you play with such abandon, and it's so jazz and rhythm and blues influenced, mm-hmm. and it's so different from that real like four square kind of singing that you usually hear on those shows. I wonder how you felt being on, if you felt out of context.
I feel fine. If they let me blow, I'll blow. I just wonder how they feel, because I'm not changing my style. I'm just going on. I might adjust a little bit, you know, try to pull it back a little bit for them so it won't really shock them so much. But I'm going to be Vernard Johnson. In the end, it's going to come out Vernard Johnson.
Now, your father was a minister, so you grew up
right.
in the church. What kind of ministry did he have?
He was a pastor of the Church of God in Christ. I grew up in the Church of God in Christ. And my dad pastored the Church of God in Christ in Kansas City, Kansas. He just passed about a year ago. And that's where I get all this jubilistic background from, because, you know, we call them the saints. The saints would get happy, and, you know, we'd play in the church, play the music, and it would be a joyous, jubilistic time.
I really love your music, and I'm very moved by it, but it's also like really kind of invigorating. But I wonder how you feel about someone like me who really feels they're reached by your music, but not necessarily in a religious way.
Well, you know, I'm excited about it. I really am. If I can help somebody as I go along, if I can cheer someone with a word or a song, if I can show someone who's out there in life taking drugs or any other way that they're going wrong, then my living would not be in vain. And if my music can reach someone, even not in a religious way, but to touch their hearts and give them a sense of feeling better about themselves and lifting their spirits, I feel like I've helped. I feel like my living's not in vain. And so I'm excited about it. I'm excited that you even like my music, if you do.
I do.
I'm excited that you would even listen to my music. And if there's anybody out there who has never heard my music, I would be so honored. I mean, so thrilled, even if you just give me a listen.
Vernor Johnson, it was a pleasure to meet you.
Oh,
thank you very much
privilege.
For being here.
I had a lot of fun talking with you.
Vernor Johnson, his latest album, I'm Alive, is on Elektra Nonesuch. He has a new recording coming out in January on his own label, VJ Records. This is Fresh Air. I have a rundown of some of the stories coming up on All Things Considered. President Clinton spoke to radio reporters today at the White House and confirmed that he'll seek re-election in 96. Mara Liasson details the president's vision for 1995. And Margo Adams asks futurists to evaluate Newt Gingrich's vision of the future. Also, Noah Adams has a business story about giving the audience what they want in a profile of Minnesota music maven Lori Line. She started playing music in a department store and has never really left the marketplace. She sells out concert halls with her music for piano. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The world lost one of the grandest gospel singers of all time when Marianne Williams died earlier this year on July 2nd. Milo Miles has a review of a new CD retrospective called My Soul Looks Back, assembled by Williams' most passionate producer and advocate, Anthony Heilbutt.
I can't help it since the day I found my Savior. No, I just can't help it. Just can't help it. Yeah. I know God has control of me. Well, look at the way I pack my feet. I know God has control of me. Woo. And you know what?
I just can't help it.
No, no, no.
I just can't help it. I know God has control of me.
Marianne Williams had a voice that was so gregarious, insistent, mercurial, sensual, and wise that it seemed like a person all by itself. The cliché is that a singer makes you feel that he or she is singing to you alone. But listening to Williams went way beyond the sense of performer and audience. You were in a presence with that voice and swept up in it. The last notes of her songs were like waking from rapture. This is a performance dedicated to Dr. Martin Luther King a few days after he was assassinated.
I imagine that Dr. King thought in his mind, as he was standing there over that balcony, he said, at the river, Lord, Lord, I stand. Take my hand, precious Lord, please.
Ageless Numbers by Williams can be found in the Columbia anthologies The Gospel Sound and Precious Lord. But the glory of the collection My Soul Looks Back is that it covers both 30 years of Williams' career and the widest range of styles and moods on any of her albums. She could be playful and sarcastic as well as exultant and profoundly reverent. But devotion to Marianne Williams is surely best rewarded when she becomes the triumphant supplicant. No gospel interpreter sounds more sadly battered by earthly ordeals, yet none casts them aside with such assurance. When Williams' voice breaks free in the midst of Poor Pilgrim of Sorrow, it is a victory for the spirit of anyone who hears. As long as that song lasts, heaven will be your home, too. The performances selected for My Soul Looks Back are very basic in structure. Piano, organ, and drums is about as elaborate as the accompaniment gets. This isn't really the only way to appreciate Marianne Williams, but it does zero in on that voice. Of course, Williams still influences almost everyone whose singing comes from black gospel. Her vocals remain the definition of passion and song. She never sang secular tunes, never dithered about it. She was under-recorded for long stretches, but was well-documented in her later years. In her case, faith came through. But it doesn't matter what you believe when you approach her. You will believe in Marianne Williams.
Myla Miles is a music critic based in Boston who writes for the New York Times and the Village Voice. He reviewed Marianne Williams' My Soul Looks Back. And with the music of Marianne Williams, we conclude our series on religion and faith. The series was produced by Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. Where the sun never goes down. Every day I'm making half a run. Hello, Pat. Get ready to go. Getting ready. Get ready to go.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we look back at the year's best in pop music and film with rock critic Ken Tucker and film critic Stephen Schiff. They'll both have their 10 best lists. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.